Welcome to this special edition of Political Rewind. Before we begin our conversation with Watergate Special Prosecutor Richard Benveniste, I thought it might make sense to take a moment and go over the basic timeline of how the Watergate scandal unfolded. You'll hear Jim Galloway and I ask questions of Benveniste about some of these events, but a roadmap may be useful. On June 17, 1972, five men were caught breaking into Democratic National Committee headquarters at the Watergate complex in Washington, D.C. And that's where it all begins. 2 days later, the first link to the Nixon re-election campaign was reported by the Washington Post. The Post had learned that one of the men arrested was James McCord, who was a salaried security coordinator for the re-election campaign. That put John Mitchell, one of Nixon's closest advisors and the head of the re-election campaign, in the spotlight. He denied that there was any connection between the break-in and the re-election campaign. But in the months ahead, the Washington Post broke many big stories that brought the scandal closer and closer to the door of the Oval Office. In September 1972, the Post reported that John Mitchell, while serving as Attorney General, had overseen a secret fund that financed widespread spying on Democrats. A month later, the Post reported that the Watergate break-in was part of that spying operation and was conducted on behalf of the Nixon re-election effort.
The Washington Post reported today that high Republican officials ordered a major political campaign of spying and sabotage against the Democrats to reassure President Nixon's re-election this year.
Nevertheless, on November 7, 1972, Richard Nixon was re-elected president in one of the largest landslides in American political history.
Thanks for making our last campaign the very best one of all. Thank you.
The pace of the Watergate scandal stepped up in early 1973. In late January, the burglars, including Nixon aides McCord and G. Gordon Liddy, were convicted of burglary and conspiracy. On March 21st, the president's White House counsel, John Dean, sat down with Nixon and his top advisor, H.R. Haldeman, to say that the scandal was getting out of control.
I think that there's no doubt about the seriousness of the problem we've got. We have a cancer within close to the presidency. It's growing. It's growing daily. It's compounding. It grows geometrically now.
In late April, the noose tightens. Nixon's top aides, Haldeman and John Ehrlichman, were forced to resign. And on the same day, John Dean was fired.
Good evening. I want to talk to you tonight from my heart on a subject of deep concern to every American.
That night, the president went on television to explain Watergate for the first time to the nation.
In recent months, members of my administration and officials of the Committee for the Re-election of the President have been charged with involvement in what has come to be known as the Watergate affair. The inevitable result of these charges has been to raise serious questions about the integrity of the White House itself. Tonight, I wish to address those questions.
In May 1973, the Senate Watergate Committee began nationally televised hearings, and Nixon Attorney General Designate Elliot Richardson appointed Archibald Cox as special prosecutor to get to the bottom of Watergate.
I've accepted the post, not without an odd sense of responsibility. The tasks are of enormous importance and enormous magnitude.
So now let's pick up our conversation with Richard Benveniste, who became a key member of Cox's team and who was assigned to oversee the investigation of the Watergate cover-up. When were you appointed to the team of special prosecutors?
I was appointed after being interviewed by Archie Cox number two, Jim Vorenberg, who is also a Harvard professor, in late June, and my first day on the job was the 4th of July, 1973.
You were an incredibly young fellow.
Yes, I was 30 years old, but I had already been a federal prosecutor for 5 years by that time in the office of Robert Morgenthau and then Mike Seymour, two outstanding U.S. attorneys in the Southern District of New York.
So just to frame it again, May 18th, the Senate Watergate Committee began the televised hearings that you talked about.
We are beginning these hearings today in an atmosphere of utmost gravity. The questions that have been raised in the wake of the June 17 break-in strike at the very undergirding of our democracy.
And it was on that same day that the Attorney General designate, Elliot Richardson, tapped Archibald Cox to become the special prosecutor. And as you say, you were then brought in within a month or so after that time, right? If we got the context right?
That's right.
Okay. It was in July that Alexander Butterfield revealed in his testimony before the Congressional Committee that Nixon had recorded all the conversations and telephone calls in his office.
Mr. Butterfield, are you aware of the installation of any listening devices in the Oval Office of the President?
I was aware of listening devices. Yes, sir.
When were those devices placed in the Oval Office?
Approximately the summer of 1970. I cannot begin to recall the precise date. My guess, Mr. Thompson, is that the installation was made between, and this is a very rough guess, April or May of 1970 and perhaps the end of the summer or early fall 1970.
Do you remember your response to hearing that, your personal response?
Well, we were incredulous. This was either an amazingly positive development for us, the opportunity to verify what others were saying about the Nixon administration's involvement in a cover-up of really massive size, starting with the notion that this was a frolic by persons unaffiliated with the administration or the reelection campaign. It was either that or a trap. It was possible that the announcement of the existence of tape recordings was something that the administration had cooked up and was going to provide us with a full stop to our investigation somehow.
It took James Comey 3 days to kind of realize that the corroboration was possible. But it was rather instantaneous with you folks, I take it.
Well, it was obvious from the announcement that either if there were tapes, we would have a tremendous resource to verify what the people had already testified to under oath. Comey, on the other hand, simply called the president's bluff immediately by saying, gosh, I hope there are tapes, because what I say will be corroborated. I've testified under oath. And I have no fear of there being tape recordings. Similarly, John Dean was entirely corroborated in his Senate testimony by the tapes that were eventually produced after considerable tumult.
Make sure our listeners know what you mean when you say that the tapes revealed Dean was telling a true story.
Well, once we got the tapes, and that's jumping far ahead in the story, Dean's testimony was, if anything, somewhat conservative given the explosive nature of the revelations on the tape.
Now, he was White House counsel to
yes.
the president.
Yes, he was. And the president had at a later time decided that certain people were going to take the fall, and Dean was a designated spear catcher. Dean, in the face of that, decided that he would cooperate with the prosecution, and we then got his testimony after he pleaded guilty to one count, conspiracy to obstruct justice, a felony, and he eventually testified at the trial of Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Mitchell, and other top lieutenants to the president. But his testimony was entirely consistent with what was on the tapes. So he became, in my view, and until this day, the most corroborated witness I've ever had.
So let's make clear something that is similar to what we're watching unfold today with the Trump White House. Your investigation, the special counsel's investigation, was going on simultaneous with the Senate Watergate committee investigation. So you were working toward the same goal, but you were on two separate tracks. Information that came out of those hearings certainly was beneficial, though, to you in your investigation. Is that a correct statement?
That's correct. There was enough scandal to go around, believe me. The work that had been done by the Senate was entirely consistent with what we were doing. We built upon it. They were incredibly helpful in terms of generating information that we utilized as a foundation for what we were doing.
How much coordination was there between the two? So to make sure that the Senate hearing didn't step on your investigation or compromise it.
Well, there was very little coordination. In fact, Archie Cox early on moved forward to try to block John Dean's immunized testimony before the Senate. Not a very well-known fact, and probably not Archie's finest moment, because the Senate had an independent obligation to conduct an investigation, and while it wasn't completely seamless with ours, it proved to be a very important step forward in moving the ball, in developing the facts, which was the ultimate goal of both the Senate and the Watergate Special Prosecution Force.
That's interesting because if we compare it to what's happening in Washington today, you have Bob Mueller going up to the Hill to brief, privately of course, both the House and Senate Intelligence Committee to some extent on what he's learning, but also to coordinate to make sure that they are on the Hill are not, in fact, stepping on anything that he's doing in his investigation, if I have that right. It's different than what you're talking about in Watergate.
That's true. There's a lot of water over the dam since Watergate and now, including the Ali North episode in Iran-Contra, where the Senate improvidently granted immunity to North and Poindexter and others, and that resulted in the inability, ultimately, to prosecute North and Poindexter because of that immunized testimony. So now they're a lot more careful in the Congress to try to avoid that situation from recurring.
We're going to take a break right now, but when we come back, Jim Galloway and I will continue our conversation with former Watergate Special Prosecutor Richard Benveniste. You're listening to a special edition of Political Rewind.
Hi, I'm John Lester, the Associate Vice President for University Relations at Columbus State University. Columbus State University is a comprehensive institution about 90 miles from Atlanta. We're known for our business programs. Our fine arts facilities are among the finest in the Southeast. We support public broadcasting because the programming creates different ways of thinking about things, and those are the same kind of values that we hold dear to our heart at a university.
To find out more about becoming a corporate sponsor, email sponsorship@gpb.org.
On the next Fresh Air.
I've been strapped in, you know, physically, to point shoes, strapped into a leotard and tights for my whole entire life.
Wendy Whalen, former principal ballerina with the New York City Ballet, reflects on what it was like to retire after nearly 30 years with the company and start a new life. She's the subject of a new documentary, Restless Creature. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Welcome back to this special edition of Political Rewind. If you're just joining us, AJC political writer Jim Galloway and I are talking about the history of the Watergate affair. Our guest is Richard Benveniste. He was one of the top members of the Watergate team of special prosecutors. White House aide Alexander Butterfield had revealed to the Senate Watergate Committee the existence of secret tapes of all of the president's meetings in the Oval Office. But Nixon adamantly refused to make those tapes available to the committee or to the special prosecutors. Despite a subsequent court order, the White House refused to honor subpoenas that were issued to get those tapes, And so the matter seemed destined for the Supreme Court. But on October 20th, 1973, the president made a decision that shook the country to its core. He fired Special Prosecutor Cox and accepted the resignations of his Attorney General and Deputy Attorney General, both of whom refused to carry out Nixon's orders to fire Cox. The president's actions that night became famously known as the Saturday Night Massacre. You were right in the middle of all that, and I'd love to take you back to that for a few minutes. It's October 20th, 1973. I went back and I looked at news footage. I looked at the various anchors on that Saturday night going on the air with their special reports about what happened that night.
Good evening. There are reports tonight that President Nixon has ordered Attorney General Elliot Richardson to fire the special Watergate prosecutor, Archibald Cox.
The country tonight is in the midst of what may be the most serious constitutional crisis in its history.
The dispute over those secret presidential Watergate tapes has produced more casualties. White House spokesman Ronald Ziegler announcing tonight that special Watergate prosecutor Archibald Cox has been fired.
The president does not want to turn over the tapes, and he cannot get either Attorney General Richardson or his deputy, Ruckelshaus, to get rid of Cox, so he fires them as well. What was that night like?
It was among the scariest times that I've ever experienced in this country. It was very much like a coup d'etat, because our offices were taken over by force.
Wow, I never knew that.
By the FBI on Nixon's orders. We had our own security. We had, of course, we had security at our office, both security that prevented electronic intrusion, and we had physical security, armed Secret Service uniformed personnel who guarded our offices 24/7. And who became friends of ours because we were there 12, 14, 16 hours a day as we were working toward completing the investigation. And so the FBI came in and said, move over, folks, we're taking over, and they seized our files. It was a very, very fraught situation, very much, in my mind, like a coup d'etat. The courts had ruled that we were entitled to the tapes, and yet the president had sent essentially paramilitary armed forces to take over our offices and seize our files.
At the risk of embarrassing myself, who's the FBI director at that time?
Well, that's an interesting question. There was an acting director, Patrick Gray, at the time.
So you have a wonderful sentence in the Atlantic article you wrote about this. That night, FBI's come in. They've thrown you out of the offices. They've seized your offices and files. And you say this, homeless, leaderless, and dazed by our proximity to the explosion the president had detonated in our midst, we brushed ourselves off and vowed to continue our work in whatever capacity we could. By this time, let me ask you this. President Trump likes to talk and see the world in terms of friends and enemies. And I can't help but wonder, despite your efforts to be as straightforward, as objective in doing your investigation as possible, by this point, would you have had to come to the conclusion that the president of the United States was the enemy of this investigation and, in fact, was your enemy as one of the chief prosecutors?
No. As a matter of fact, we were at a stage where, of course, allegations had been made about the president's involvement, but we were in the process of determining, as best we could, whether those allegations had sufficient force and validity and corroboration to be able to bring charges against any of the coterie of Nixon's top aides. What Nixon did in firing Cox certainly gave us and the American people reason to question why he would take such a step if he was, in fact, not involved in a criminal way in the various things that we were investigating. And so it certainly did not improve our impression of the president. But at that point, we didn't have the evidence that we needed. We had testimony. We had he said, particularly John Dean and others, but principally Dean, about the president's involvement in a large conspiracy to obstruct justice. It was only until we got the tape recordings in Nixon's own voice that we could corroborate the other testimony that we had. There, Nixon incriminated himself in plain and simple terms in taking steps to continue an obstruction of justice, and then we learned that he was an early architect of that obstruction of justice, sending a representative of the CIA to the FBI with a bogus explanation as to why the FBI should curtail its investigation into money found on the burglars at the time they were arrested. And so that made pretty much a slam dunk case that we transmitted to the House Impeachment Committee that was looking into whether President Nixon should be impeached.
If I could, let me ask you, there was a third investigation going on, of course, or maybe a fourth, you know, by the Washington Post and the New York Times. And, of course, Woodward and Bernstein were famously advised to follow the money. And I'm wondering how important was financial data to your investigation, because to me it seems like there is a fairly strong parallel here with what Robert Mueller is doing right now in examining the financial links between Russia and certain members of the Trump campaign.
The idea that Woodward and Bernstein were instructed by Deep Throat to, quote, follow the money was actually an invention of Woodward and Bernstein to make the story a little sexier. They acknowledge that that was never said. But
I'm heartbroken.
But the fact was that the money chain did, in fact, tie the committee to reelect the president to the burglars in a profoundly convincing way. So money was important, but the question of Nixon's personal involvement and the personal involvement of Mitchell, Haldeman, and Ehrlichman in the obstruction of justice was solidified by tape recordings in their own words that they could not wriggle free from.
I want to close the loop, if I may, because we sort of left you having been kicked out of your offices on October 20th and having your files taken. The uproar, and I think all of us who are of age remember it well, that started that Saturday night and continued over the next days, was so tumultuous that the president had no choice but to relent, to name a new special prosecutor, Leon Jaworski, and to put you all back in business with your files again, right?
Well, he didn't put us back in business because he had neglected to fire us.
Okay.
we were there, you know, sort of collateral damage, you know, blown up, but not in pieces. We quickly decided amongst ourselves that it would be pointless to think about resigning in protest as to what the president had done to our leader. So we resolved we would just wait and continue do what we could until such time as we got the axe. But instead, the public opinion and the congressional opinion was so fierce that Nixon reversed course. He announced that he would, in fact, turn over the tapes, and he eventually selected Leon Jaworski to take over leadership of the Watergate Special Prosecution Force. And Jaworski, to his credit, kept everybody who was already on the Watergate prosecution team in place. He brought no one on his own, not even a secretary, and he immediately established credibility with us because, you know, quite frankly, he was selected by Nixon, and as such, we had some serious basis for suspicion as to whether he, as to whether he was picked to perpetrate the biggest fix of all time. But he was radicalized when he listened to that first group of tapes that eventually got turned over. He listened to Nixon. Nixon clearly told Dean, who had come to his office on March 21, 1973, to tell Nixon that the cover-up couldn't go on any longer. It was insupportable. They wanted money for keeping quiet. Dean didn't know how to really conduct a long-term operation like that. He was running out of money. People were starting to get nervous. The possibility of the whole thing breaking up was driving Dean to distraction. And Dean had come to the president and said, look, you need to save yourself. People have to go to jail. We've obstructed justice here. And I, for one, will go to jail. Others need to go to jail. But you, the president, need to save yourself by putting an end to it. In fact, Nixon told him to continue.
When Jaworski was given the replacement job, and you were allowed back in your offices, I mean, was everything there as you left it? Were there things missing?
Yes, everything we had generated was there. We had our tapes that were sent over, came over. We then refined the transcripts of those tapes. We had grand jury transcripts of testimony, some of which was provable perjury. And so we had what we needed. Once we got the tapes, that was more than the icing on the cake. That was the cake that we needed for the big party.
If I'm correct, your role at that point, you were in charge of investigating the cover-up and primarily. Is that right at that point?
Yes.
So with that in mind, what happened when you realized, when you finally got the tapes, that there was that now legendary 18-minute gap? How did you proceed as the man in charge of the cover-up to try to deal with that?
Well, you can imagine that I was somewhat skeptical about whether this was an innocent accident. And so our team got to work, and we persuaded Judge Sirica that we ought to have a hearing on the subject of these obliterated tape recordings. And we did, and we got several different stories from the White House. And by the end of the day, we worked our way from the bowels of the White House, where the tapes were being stored and generated by Secret Service technicians, up to Chief of Staff to the President, Alexander Haig, famously testified under my questioning that it must have been some sinister force that erased the tapes. And I think that was pretty close to what actually happened.
Any theories on what was missing there?
Oh, well, you know that the conversation that was erased had to do with Watergate. This was the first opportunity that Nixon and his top aides had reassembled in the White House after they had been on trips to either California or Florida. And so this was only days after the break-in where they got together. And it's quite clear from Haldeman's notes that Watergate was discussed. The actual words were lost forever because they were deliberately erased. We know that because a joint panel of experts picked by the White House and the Watergate Special Prosecution Force, studied the tapes. These were the foremost scientists in the country with experience in tape recording. And they could see that on 5 to 7 separate instances, the tape was in fact erased. Someone had gone back, erased, gone forward, erased, erased again and again, up to seven times. So that was established.
So it wasn't Rosemary
Poor
Woods.
Poor Rosemary
here.
Wood.
A month ago, Rosemary Woods demonstrated it happened this way, her foot on the recorder floor pedal while stretching for a phone call. Today, her balancing act tumbled to the floor. The expert said it could not possibly have happened this way.
Well, it may have been, but not in the way that she had explained, that she was inattentively on the telephone and had pressed the erase button on her reel-to-reel tape recorder. In fact, that was totally improbable, as we determined in court, but it's not to say that she was not complicit with the president in erasing that particular tape.
So let me move you forward, if I may. So on July 27th, the House Judiciary Committee started passing articles of impeachment. Was it clear during the investigation that a president of the United States cannot be indicted on a criminal offense while sitting in office? Because clearly that's an issue that is being discussed today in terms of President Trump. And is that correct?
I don't believe it's clear, and we didn't think it was clear at the time. The way we looked at it, and there was difference of opinion within our office, but the way I looked at it personally was that there obviously would be or could be circumstances where a sitting president ought to be charged with a crime. For example, if the president were to kill somebody in front of witnesses, would we wait for an impeachment to suspend him from his active role as president of the United States? I think that's a different circumstance, obviously, than what we faced during Watergate. We had an active Congress, and the most significant difference between then and now is that Congress was controlled by the opposition party from the president. The Democrats controlled both houses of Congress during Watergate. Now both houses of Congress are controlled by the same party. So the question is whether there would be the same kind of robust investigation conducted as was then because of party loyalty. So I'm not suggesting that the evidence is there at this point. It is not, as far as we can see. However, at the time, I felt, and others felt, and most importantly, Leon Jaworski felt, that because there was an active investigation going on, and the Constitution provides a mechanism for removing a president from office by way of impeachment, that that was the proper way to go. And what we did was apply to the court. At the time, we returned indictments for permission to provide the House Impeachment Committee with essentially a roadmap, evidence that we had collected that demonstrated President Nixon's involvement in the conspiracy to obstruct justice. And we did so.
Of course, President Nixon never did face an impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate. As the House began voting on impeachment articles, the president accepted the inevitable.
Good evening. This is the 37th time I have spoken to you from this office.
And on August 8, 1974, he announced his resignation from the office of the presidency.
Throughout the long and difficult period of Watergate, I have felt it was my duty to persevere. In the past few days, however, it has become evident to me that I no longer have a strong enough political base in the Congress to justify continuing that effort. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
It had taken a little more than 2 years from the break-in for the crisis to bring down President Nixon. We're going to take another break right now, but when we come back, Jim Galloway and I will ask Ben Veniste about the parallels he sees between Watergate and the Russia investigation.
Many of us have trouble turning off our smartphones, but for some people, the internet is just as addictive as drugs.
Their brains start looking like those of someone who has a substance use disorder. Similar pathways seem activated.
The science behind internet addiction and what it means for adolescent brains this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Hear All Things Considered from 4 till 7 this afternoon on GPB.
If you want to understand this world, just follow the money.
Chicken is a big business. We are a chicken nation.
In terms of a whitewater year, this is going to rank in the top five.
The running joke in Hollywood is that no movies ever make money.
Oil, of course, is the lifeblood of modern civilization.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Stories from all over the economy next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6, right here on your GPB station.
Financial contributions from listeners like you are not the only gifts that keep GPB on the air. In fact, many listeners have already chosen to donate a used vehicle to GPB. We'll pick up your vehicle for free and send you the paperwork for your taxes. Get started today. Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or go to gpb.org/cars. That's 877-GPB-1-CAR or gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
Welcome back to our special edition of Political Rewind. We're talking with former Watergate special prosecutor Richard Benveniste. After asking him to take us through the history of Watergate, we wanted to hear his take on the parallels between Watergate and the Russia investigation. Jim Galloway started the questions.
I'd like to address the piece that you wrote for The Atlantic on the parallels that you're seeing right now.
Sure.
Take it away.
Well, you start with the fact that there's a great similarity in the underlying events, although I would suggest that the events in the present situation, if we can call it Russiagate for purposes of encapsulating it, are more serious. In Watergate, you had one political party's re-election committee conducting electronics surveillance and breaking into the headquarters of the opposing party.
If I could jump in just for our younger viewers, that organization was called CREEP.
The Committee to Re-Elect the President. Yeah, an unfortunate acronym, I suggest. But the break-in and wiretapping in which the culprits were apprehended red-handed on the scene was the beginning of Watergate, as we know it, and although there had been other kinds of intrusions and illegal activities sponsored by the Committee to Re-Elect the President, here in Russiagate, we have surveillance of an electronic nature and hacking, modern tools of intrusion, illegal, by the Russians, according to our intelligence agencies, for the purpose of affecting our election. And one would suggest that that's far more serious in its underlying nature than what happened in Watergate. So you start with that parallel, and there are several others. Watergate, President Nixon decided that he would fire Archibald Cox, who was named as a special prosecutor, to investigate whether there was a connection between higher-ups and the burglars in the Watergate break-in and bugging. And to do that, he had to go through the Attorney General and the Deputy Attorney General, who both refused to carry out the president's order to fire Cox, because Cox had been promised independence and was promised that he would be fired only for impropriety. And there was no impropriety. He was merely doing his job in pursuing the tape recordings that Alexander Butterfield had disclosed. So while people were not paying much attention to Watergate, they went along with the White House description of it being a third-rate burglary unconnected to those in the White House for quite some time. But now the president had gone through the step of firing Archibald Cox, the investigator, and in the course of that, causing the Attorney General and the Deputy Attorney General to resign rather than carry out the order. So now the public woke up, and they asked quite properly, why was Nixon firing them at the cost of losing important people in his administration? What was he hiding? The parallel here is that President Trump has fired the head of the FBI, Mr. Comey, for reasons that he later explained, contrary to the story the White House immediately put out, that he was uncomfortable with the FBI's investigation into the Russian involvement in the hacking of our 2016 election, and decided to fire Comey for that reason.
The American people, when you were investing Watergate, I think the president's approval rating was in the mid-30s for much of that, much as President Trump's is today. So he did have a core that still stayed with him. But we accepted facts in 1972, 73, and 74. We understood that there were truths that could not be ducked. And it strikes me that while there were some Republicans who were, you point out in writing about this, who were heroic and put country above party, they also had, I think, the understanding that their constituents were beginning to see clearly what was happening. I don't think that's necessarily true or will be true today. Do you?
I think there's a different feeling in the land, and there's certainly the interjection of remarkable things almost on a daily basis coming from the White House. The press is the enemy. Statements like fake news.
Fake news. CNN, fake.
And the like. And so this is a different environment. But I have faith in the American public, and that's not to say that the evidence is there at this point. But if the evidence can be proved, and most importantly, if Mr. Mueller is allowed to continue his investigation to conclusion, which was the premise of the article I wrote, then we will see, we'll have a basis to see. And if the president interferes with that process by firing Mueller, as has been speculated and as certain of his supporters have urged him to do, then we'll know that something very, very dangerous is occurring. And it will determine whether we continue to be a nation of laws if a lawful investigation conducted by a person lawfully appointed to do his job is somehow truncated.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Can you, I mean, obviously, you were on the scene there, but I mean, you did have your Republican senators who stepped up. Principal, the most prominent above them was Howard. Among them was Howard Baker. But if I remember, he kind of sacrificed his political career. I mean, because he tried to. I think he tried to launch a presidential campaign after that. It failed. He ended up as chief of staff, I think, for Ronald Reagan, but his career was foreshortened by what he did in Watergate.
You know, the people who put country above party were not doing it for purposes of advancing their ultimate political future. They were doing it because they were patriots and they believed in our system. And I think that's what is essential to understanding what happened then. And should this progress down the same lane as Watergate, and I certainly hope it doesn't, we will see who will pass the test and who will fail.
In closing, you know, it's been interesting to prepare for our conversation because I'm 70 years old. So Watergate all played out when I was a young adult. But you were in the middle of one of the most remarkable periods of American history. And for a period of more than a year, it felt to me as if time was suspended and we were completely focused on what was happening with your investigation, with Congress's work in Washington, and you were in the middle of it all. And I wonder, as you reflect back on that, two things. Clearly, you understand what an important period of time you were involved with. But you also ended up coming to the conclusion that the president of the United States might, in fact, be a criminal. I'm wondering if, as we close, you could reflect on those two things for just a moment or two.
Well, at the end of the day, once we had the evidence that we were able to obtain, then the conclusion was clear. The president had clearly involved himself in a conspiracy to obstruct justice and had, along the way, conducted himself by abusing the powers of his office in a significant way. So what did this tell us? It told us that the power of the presidency is enormous, that removing a president was no easy task and should not be undertaken lightly. However, under the circumstances, it showed that the system worked, that our founding fathers, in their brilliance, produced a system that was able to work without bloodshed and according to the way in which it was designed to work. However, you should also know that it almost didn't work because Nixon made every wrong move at every important intersection, and that the people who were charged with conducting the investigation, John Sirica, the judge, the Supreme Court, Peter Rodino, who is head of the impeachment committee, Senator Irvin, a Southern Democrat, all performed admirably, as did, of course, Archie Cox and Leon Jaworski. And the small role that the staff had, we felt we did our jobs well. But the lesson is that it doesn't always have to work, and it requires intense collaboration with the American people to preserve their democracy, and we're not going to have it.
Did you ever think our democracy might be at stake?
Sure. It would determine whether we were a nation of laws or whether naked power would supplant law. Archie Cox was duly invested as independent special prosecutor with power to investigate. That power was taken away through use of force by the President of the United States, who was among the subjects of the investigation. Now, that is fundamentally incompatible with our democracy. And had we not rallied as a country and said, this will not stand, then our country would be compromised in terms of its most basic values.
Richard Benveniste was one of the key members of the team of special prosecutors who investigated the Watergate scandal, first under Prosecutor Archibald Cox, and later, after Cox was fired in the Saturday Night Massacre, under Leon Jaworski. Benveniste went on to other high-profile work. He was the Democratic counsel on the U.S. Senate's Whitewater Committee, which in 1995 and 96 investigated a variety of allegations raised about the business dealings of Bill and Hillary Clinton. Then, in the wake of the 9/11 terrorist attacks, he was appointed to the 9/11 Commission, which was charged with preparing a complete report on the circumstances surrounding the attacks and with making recommendations for guarding against future terrorist activity. By a coincidence of timing, our show today with Benveniste comes just as the New York Times is reporting a story that may prove crucial to Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation of possible ties between the Trump campaign and Russia. The Times reports that Donald Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, and former Trump campaign chief Paul Manafort met last June with a Russian lawyer said to have ties to the Kremlin. Trump Jr. first said the meeting was about the obstacles Americans face in adopting Russian babies. But when he was confronted with contrary information, he acknowledged that the meeting was arranged because the lawyer said she had information damaging to Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. Trump Jr. said it became apparent quickly that the woman's information was groundless, and he ended the session. But it is one more example of a meeting that was held between a Trump advisor and Russians during the campaign and after the election. Of course, we'll follow the story on Political Rewind in the weeks ahead. We'll be back with another live edition of Political Rewind Wednesday at 2. Sandy Springs Mayor and former Georgia GOP State Chairman Rusty Paul will be here for that show. And we'll also be joined by former WSB-TV political reporter Lori Geary. Then on Friday, AJC Washington reporter Tamar Hallerman and Democratic State Senator Nan Orrick will be in the studio for our 3 p.m. live show. That's all the time we have for today. Our associate producer, Olivia Rheingold, edited our show today. Our senior producer is Jenny Ament, and our producer is Lisa Clark. I'm Bill Nygut. I hope to see you again on Wednesday at 2 for another Political Rewind.